Hey listeners, if you love The Santhro Life and you want to support the show, Anchor.fm makes it super easy to do. They give you options to donate $1, $5, or $10 on a monthly basis. Whatever you choose to support us with, we're grateful to have you, and it's going to help us produce better and better content.
And now, on to the show.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the first episode of the second season of This Anthropological Life. Today, we're in to talk about beer and all of its multifaceted forms in our culture and society, and what anthropology has to say with it.
It's one of these theories postulates that when we used to start collecting barley would grow in certain places around Mesopotamia and what's now the Middle East, and people would make sort of clay jugs to sort of hold the barley in. And of course, when you're hunting and gathering, you're moving from place to place. So what they would do is they would just leave the barley in these pots or pans or cases, and then leave and go hunting and gathering, come back a couple days later and eat the barley. But sometimes it would rain, as tends to happen with the weather outside, and these pots weren't covered. And so the idea is that it would then rain on top of it. And then if it rained more than once and it sort of filled it up, a little bit of rain would start activating the barley and it would start to sprout. And then it rains again and sort of, you know, there's a deluge of water in the barley, and then it starts to ferment. And so when people would come back from hunting and gathering a couple of days later, they would look and say their barley's all wet. Oh, man, what are we going to do with this? But then they would, some brave soul took a sip of this barley water mixture and then realized, we have something here. And thus was the invention of beer. You know, a natural process in many ways, but again, that sort of set the course, they say, of the rise of this type of sedentary lifestyle.
Right, a sort of happy accident that this even came into being. But I'd like to add that what we see with evidence of beer today is based upon ceramics. But there's potential for earlier fermentations of beer and other alcohols through baskets. Because baskets don't preserve as well in the archaeological record, but baskets would retain water in the same way. So people were probably still doing it. And then later on started firing clay jugs. And one of the hypotheses that really is starting to get a little bit more weight these days is that the glass, the clayware, was actually your happy drinking vessel. That people would, dish these out at parties, and that would be your drinking cup. And then at the end of it, you go and smash your drinking cup type of thing.
Yeah, a whole ritual in and of itself.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, it's incredibly interesting, also when we think about the history of beer is also how we in the present are projecting onto that history.
Yep.
And, what exactly we wish to gain from it, even that we call all these different drinks beer. It has a meaning in and of itself. There's a great Google Talk on YouTube that you guys can all check out by Sam Calagione, who's one of the heads of Dogfish Brewery. You guys are familiar with them. And he's incredibly interested in this idea of going back to our past and thinking about how we can view beer differently. There's an idea really established in Germany that, beer should be made of four key ingredients: hops, malt, water, and yeast. And of course, a lot of the idea of this was a standardization, similar to when they standardized vodka in Russia in the 1800s. This idea that we need to really preserve and understand what exactly we do as a society and what exactly beer is. I'm sure a lot of you guys have seen those shirts, beer is culture, around the place. And, it's incredibly interesting to think what exactly this means. And I think, Adam, you have a lot of very interesting thoughts on this.
Yeah, I like the idea of thinking of beer as culture. It's a wonderful idea. And it can mean so many things. I mean, for one, here in our wonderful state of Massachusetts, the culture of craft brewing is really quite alive and well. I mean, there's some 22 new breweries that are petitioned to be opened by the Massachusetts Brewers Association. And I think 15 new ones have opened up in the past 3 years. So, I mean, there's a huge explosion of new brewer culture, of how we can grow our beers. And Neil, as you said, there's a certain tradition, or we could say a culture, of what ingredients should be put in beer. But of course, there's a fun side of this too, kind of harkening back to our multi-species episode last season, that beer itself is a culture. It's made of cultures of yeast, right, of certain bacteria. And so even what makes beer itself is a culture, as well as, the sort of activities that we do around beer, whether it is the traditions of smashing our clay jugs, or just saying prost and pushing our glasses together. after a long, hard day at work or something, right? But again, so beer is a really wonderful example, aside being a wonderful beverage, that really covers so many aspects of what we might think of as culture, being from a biological aspect of these different cultures of yeast, all the way to how a beer should be made, what ingredients should be used, what activities should go around beer, right? When is it appropriate to drink beer, with whom, and why?
Right, and even what vessels are you going to drink your beer out of? As we know today, different types of beers come in different types of serving glasses. And that's very important for a lot of people and how beer etiquette is supposed to be. And that's another thing that gets into this culture of beer. It's, again, the materials that come around beer and not just the beer itself. And how beer is even structuring our social practices.
And we can think about that, too, in terms of where the word even, culture even comes from, right? This comes from Latin, which is cultus. And, of course, when we talk about doing cultural anthropology and archaeology. And cultus is Latin for to farm or to till or again, to cultivate. And so if you think about it, these notions of agriculture, horticulture, viniculture, or beer culture, whatever we might call that, you know, are based around, again, this sort of attachment to the land, the certain usage of material surroundings, our environment, our landscape, are somewhat shaped. And so culture, again, is not this sort of abstract thing just out there. But again, it's very much tied to the material landscape. And of course, in our case, beer, the ingredients that are used to make beer. And again, there's an interesting, Neil, as you said, this tradition, sort of the German lager tradition, right, to make these this certain kind of beer that you're going to have, your hops and your barley, and these specific examples. But again, of course, as our friend from Dogfish Head Brewery points out, that there's why are we calling all of these kinds of things beer? Again, what Dogfish is kind of famous for doing, they have beers such as Teo Bromo, which Ryan and I were talking about, which is sort of built off of, is it an Aztec recipe?
Maya recipe,
that has cacao, which is, you know, used to make chocolate, and different ingredients that are, you know,
like,
obviously...
Chili peppers
stuff, right? Yeah, if you've ever had, what's it called? They call it Maya hot chocolate, or, you know, it has chili peppers too, you know, whether it is Maya or not. But but the idea of spiking this beer with certain kind of things, there are ingredients that have to go with it, such as barley. But again, we do see other things through the material record, through human history, of different kinds of things that were put into beer, which are, again, well worth exploring. I mean, we have examples of things such as, like, special kind of peat from bogs, as well as hallucinogenics. We've seen examples of that. They would put certain kind of mushrooms in them. So you'd have this sort of holy intoxication, we could call it, right, where you can sort of attach yourself or see a new world just by drinking beer.
Yeah. And I think the Dogfish case is really fascinating because, of course, anthropologists are, you know, incredibly involved in it. Mm-hmm. You have archaeologists working with Dogfish, analyzing the pottery, figuring out what the ingredients were used. And, you know, it's fascinating how Dogfish is at the same time really trying to reinvent how we think about beer. They're also trying to ground what they do in the past. They try to look at the archaeological record, our ideas of our history, to affirm what they're doing and give meaning to the process. They really are adding culture or making a very significant part of their drinking experience. And so many things go into this. And present-day breweries are constantly seeming to try to engage our history of beer and even add new traditions. You think about beer tours. You know, so much about beer drinking is about the experience. And right here in Boston, you know, we have the Sam Adams Brewery, which is free for a tour. Mm-hmm. If you're over 21, you can go there. They'll give you lots of free beer. You walk into this factory setup, which of course is not a real factory producing massive amounts of beer, but it is supposed to give you the idea, the experience, so that every time after that, when you order Sam Adams, you'll feel as if you were in a place that was, you know, you'll feel connected to this experience. You'll feel connected to holding the hops in your hand, smelling the hops. You know, it's a whole aesthetic experience. And it also goes back to, as you said, Ryan, to the even what you drink it out of, the vessel. And Sam Adams will give you a free beer glass, which they say that they've specially designed so that it amplifies the qualities of their beer, their specific beer, not just any beer, you know, certain types of Sam Adams beer. So there are lots of ideas of particularities involved in this. And anthropology especially is incredibly well engaged with its academic tools to understand this, I feel, because we're able to really analyze what these substantive ideas are and what their effects are.
Yeah, and I think what you're hitting on too is this notion of the importance of place, as we've been saying, right? And that so these hops do come from specific places, and if you go to the tour at the Sam Adams Brewery, or up to Ipswich, or I mean anywhere really, I mean Wachusett if you want to go to the nice blueberry lager, right? Any of these places will. I mean, the tour always involves where they get their hops from. You can get some from Western Massachusetts, some from Vermont, some from New Hampshire, Maine, whatever. I mean, and there's a pride of saying we get our hops, these specific kinds. We get these flown in from Bavaria or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. There's a very specific notion of place that's tied to these, and the flavor then in some ways takes you to that place, right? They say you should have this beer, you should try it, which is why again Dogfish Head is such an interesting example because again, as I said, archaeologist Patrick McGovern is working with the Dogfish team to again. And he essentially what the Smithsonian Magazine calls this guy a beer archaeologist. He's a professor of forensic brewing, which is amazing. And so again, his job is to travel the world, getting you know old liquid residues from sarcophagi and from jars and canopic jars, not canopic that holds body parts. That'd be disgusting. But you know other jars from
household
you know,
jars.
Household jars. There you go. Yeah, a really fascinating job anyway. And you know so he sort of claims to have found. We might say is like the earliest known booze of any kind, which mm-hmm. is up to 9,000 years old. It's a Neolithic grog, you can call it, from China's Yellow River Valley. Really fascinating. And again, and he's sort of responsible. He's found some of the oldest grape wine that we've seen around 5400 BC, as well as the oldest beer, barley beer that we know of is from Iran in the Zagros Mountains. It's about 3400 BC. So we can see these things dating back really far. And so again, 9,000 BC is actually pushing us a little before, in some ways, the agricultural revolution that we know of. You know, if we're talking 10,000 BC, we're talking between 10,000 and 8,000 BC, more or less. It's really kind of interesting to see this. You see these drinks coming up at the same time. You know,
it's really interesting to think about how this pull of the ancient sort of gives it an appeal, gives beer and this currency a sort of power to it. You know, we don't have many things from the ancient world that we can really fully integrate into our society today and appreciate. Usually because of a loss of preservation. Like most of the music that was ever written doesn't exist today. But if we can pull recipes of ancient beer from the past, that's something special that gets down to an experience that people thousands of years ago could have had that we can also share in today.
Absolutely right. And I mean, even with the rise of cookbooks, which is really only about 150 to 200 year old practice, you know, and sort of taking cuisine and moving it across into different spaces, saying it's available in this cookbook, but you're right. There's recipes of libations written on stone stelae, right? Predating this by thousands of years. Fascinating.
Right.
And we
predating
can,
writing.
Predating writing in some ways, right? And actually, this is a wonderful tongue-in-cheek documentary called How Beer Saved the World. Highly recommended. It's a little ethnocentric about Western history, but it does point to this fact in that perhaps once people sort of started becoming more sedentary after they, you know, wanted to cultivate more barley to make more beer, then came the rise of record keeping, bookkeeping. And cuneiform is one of the oldest forms of writing, which is just little wedges pointing different ways. And the theory kind of postulates that beer bookkeeping is one of the first reasons that we had writing. We need to count how much beer we have. And it's actually one of the earliest symbols, because once cuneiform starts being more widespread as a popular... And if you think about why would writing be spread, of course, it's usually going to be for some common medium, usually an agricultural product. Again, barley could be that product. And even in the old alphabets, they have these things called like line scripts that were like the old dictionaries. There's 160 characters related to beer. That's more than the Eskimos have for snow.
Jeez. So that shows its importance.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a huge... Yeah, I think, you know, and also thinking about the present reality of beer, especially being in the United States where we are right now, there's so many moments in our culture where I think beer has such a key, vital place. We have our this Patriots Super Bowl, or if the Patriots are in, they might not be. But, you know, we have all these traditions, 4th of July, when you have a picnic outside, there's supposed to be cold beer. Think of King of the Hill, you know, all of these country western songs. There's one that's specifically called Drink a Beer. So in our own culture, we have all of these manifestations. And right now, thinking as we were a little bit earlier about the culture of microbreweries, larger breweries, Anheuser-Busch, are also incredibly interesting to think about and what their effect is and how we view them. Because some people really feel... Anheuser-Busch is American, you know, and drinking Anheuser-Busch makes you American. Mm-hmm. And it's almost patriotic to a degree.
Right. And Budweiser did a good job of selling that. Of course, mm-hmm. they were bought by a Belgian company a couple of years ago. So this is an ironic thing there, right? But it's true. But even the fact of having a Miller Lite or a Coors Light, you know, these are also kind of associated with Americanism, right?
Oh,
but
again, yeah. of course. The Rocky Mountains, right? On a Coors can. When they had that whole campaign, you know, be as fresh as the Rockies or as cool as the Rockies.
Tap the Rockies, yeah.
And they have a picture of the mountains right on the can.
Mm-hmm. And that useless but kind of fun-looking blue mountain thing to tell you the beer is cold. In case your hand can't tell. Look, the bottle says it's cold.
Exactly.
But to think about that, too, I mean, this notion of tradition is really important, you know, because, again, we do think the Budweiser is like, and I mean, they've had an American flag on the Budweiser can for a long, they don't anymore, but they had it for a long time, you know, and the Clydesdale horses actually live in the United States, you know. But it's interesting to think about that, too, because with the rise of, again, beer culture in the United States, even Coors and Miller were German immigrants. I forget, it's like Frederick Coors and William Miller or something, or vice versa. And actually, since that was like, we talked before about the tradition of German brewing and these specific ingredients, and that's where like the idea of lager, of a certain kind of beer, came to the U.S. from Germany. And what's fascinating about that, this was again in the early 1900s, we didn't really have commercial refrigeration. So we could make beer, but you only make a certain kind of beer. Because, you know, to make lager, it has to be cold. And so, the tradition in Germany before this was to literally chip ice off of tops of mountains, ship it down to the brewery, stick it in the brew kegs to cool it so it could, you could brew it at a certain temperature. We weren't able to do that in the United States. I mean, obviously, this is why Coors is over by the Rockies, because you need to be by the mountains. Miller's in Texas, so that makes no sense. But, you know... but for the time being, you know, that's why I think it's over there in the Rockies. And so it needed this kind of thing. But again, one of the things that beer sort of postulates is the rise of commercial refrigeration, too. The fact that you and I have a refrigerator in our homes as something we don't even think about. And the size of the refrigerator, again, was in some ways paid for research and development and pushing by the beer industry, because that made beer production possible year-round. You'd only be able to make it in the wintertime.
And it has a huge impact, of course, on the experience of drinking beer. Being someone who's had lots of incredibly warm beer in India, stuck in an area without refrigeration, it's definitely much less enjoyable.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
This really is testament to how beer has been a prime mover of innovation amongst human culture, you know, across the globe. So we look at different ways that different countries, different cultures have been making beer over time in order to make it keep. You know, we have to think of the strategies that people had in order to make beer last for voyages across the ocean, or for mass transport, or for other ways of drinking it, right? So you have IPAs, which are super hoppy, and the added hops is what made them keep during long voyages from the British Navy to India.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great point too, right? I mean, we now may think of, you know, the here in Massachusetts, particularly in Cambridge and Somerville, or a number of us live, that, you know, IPAs are kind of associated with hipsters, right? It's the hipster beer, right? It's
cool. Pabst Blue Ribbon.
PBR. That you want. The more hops, it's better, you know? But really, you're right, Ryan, that, like, the hops were necessary to make it be able to get from, you know, point A to point B, which is a long ship voyage, too, you know, in Britain to India.
Initially, it wasn't the source of pride that we take it for today, but then it became transformed into it. So these ways of making these different types of beers may have humble origins, but become these larger symbols as time progresses.
Yeah, I mean, we can see this moving from, as you said before, Neil, about the notion of Budweiser seeming to be this, there's something American about Budweiser, regardless of the fact that it moved to Belgium. It's still American, right? It hasn't lost that, which is interesting. And again, as you said, IPA is like this, the humble origins of how we're going to get this all the way around Africa. Oh, I know, add more hops, right? But now it's associated with something totally different. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, you know, no less real, no less meaningful, right? And again, that's kind of a notion of some ways like polysemy, and that's like the same thing can have different meanings. And we talk about a lot, the same thing will change meaning over time, right? Especially over place, between who adopts it and why. I mean, who knows? In 60 years, maybe a lager will be the new thing for the cool kids or something. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. I think something we're also touching on here is that beer is a very ritualistic drink. And whether we're talking about ritual in the sense of religion, or we're talking about in the sense of, you know, state sort of governance, or if we're talking about rituals that we find amongst different groups of people, you know, on the smaller scale, those at the workforce, those who you are, your friends, your comrades, or even, you know, in the past, different militaries and things like that, beer has enforced, you know, a sort of congregation. and communal meetings that occur again and again and again.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, one of the things that we saw with the rise of the American Revolution, actually, and just from sort of the time that the Pilgrims or Puritans or colonists, whatever you want to call them, landed. Actually, one of the things that's funny about the history is that, you know, beer, again, as you said, beer made these sort of Atlantic or Trans-Pacific voyages even available, because you can't drink seawater, right? And you can't, and water will go bad if you just leave it sitting in a barrel for a couple days, a couple weeks, you know, it'll go. But beer could survive the voyage. And so actually when the, what do we call them, Pilgrims for now, when the Pilgrims came over from England, they actually had, you know, they had a certain amount of beer, and they were aiming for Virginia, but they ran out of beer. And they had to stop at the nearest port, and that happened to be Plymouth. So little do we know, you know, we talk about Plymouth Rock being the landing point. It's actually, I mean, it was the landing point, but because they ran out of beer. But with that then came, as you said, the sort of communal aspect of beer drinking, right? And so we see actually, starting in the United States and a little bit in Europe too, but largely in the U.S., because again, this is what they saw this as a, quote, virgin land that was sort of open and uninhabited. You know, obviously we know that's not the case, but from their perspective, that was the thing. And so they, in order to have sort of centers of meetings and communication and commerce, we see the rise of the tavern. And so not only does beer figure as a drink to get from point A to point B across the ocean, but on top of that, it becomes the meeting point, the central point for communication, where you can meet up with your workmates, your friends, to discuss what's happening in the village, what's happening in the next village, what crops are being grown. So again, it becomes this very important communal center that we still enjoy today, right? Who doesn't love a good pub? Yeah. As long as you're of age.
Yeah, beer, it has, you know, a huge role, I think, in bringing people together, as do lots of other forms of consumption. Eating with people, for instance, the idea of a family meal, even going outside, having a cigarette, you know, you talk to other smokers. A lot of smokers will say how it's really a lot of what drives them to smoke is the social aspect. Mm. So you have this combination of a slight intoxication in with cigarettes. You have nicotine with beer, you have alcohol, but then you also have the idea of the social. So while we have almost, you know, chemical reactions happening, we also have social reactions happening, and they build on top of each other. As you said about the tavern being a place of coming together, in a way, by consuming the same kind of beer, we're getting onto a common level, both socially and also chemically to a degree, in that we're consuming the same, you know, item.
It drives, again, at this point of what would you do for a beer? And again, as we look at these different circumstances that we've already talked about historically, people go out of their way to make beer, to get beer, and to have that experience of beer. And as Adam and I were talking about earlier, again, I think referencing this documentary, that beer was such a prime mover that it was even used by pharaohs to push people to build the pyramids.
It created social inequality.
Right.
That goes to a point. David Graeber once said that in studying the cities in Pakistan, actually earlier cities, and seeing the inequality levels, almost analyzing the past Gini coefficient, the level of inequality, we find that for quite a long time, actually, there was almost an egalitarianism. And one of the theories why this might have fallen apart is because alcohol started being increasingly consumed in large amounts.
Hmm. What do you mean by egalitarianism?
I mean, and just the idea that when we look at the remains, it seems as if people had more or less the same amount of stuff. There was this kind of equality, and then that decreases. And this, I think, relates perfectly with the idea that the pharaohs might have been using alcohol to really get people to build these pyramids.
That's interesting. And in some ways that, yeah, beer sort of functioned as, not only as a pusher to make people do it, but as a form of currency, too.
Right.
It was seen as such a divine, special thing that the creator god Ra was actually known as the creator of life, of love, and of beer. And in this way, beer sort of functioned as the sort of divine nice thing. And again, a form of currency. People were paid in beer.
I mean, think about it this way. If somebody asks you to go do something incredibly difficult, something you think might be impossible, you're probably going to say no. And if they offer you lump sums of money, you're probably not sure because you're not sure what that will risk. But if somebody says, well, I'll buy you a drink, I'll do a favor, I'll give you a beer, well, you might become more complacent after the first beer. And then at day two, get another beer, and another beer, and another beer.
Yeah.
You can sort of see how the regression just might take place.
That's a fair point. And to kind of put that in the Egyptian context, right, people were paid a gallon of beer a day for building the pyramids. So again, not only a currency, but it was quite a lot. I mean, so if when, you know, if we say, hey, I'll buy you a drink, we mean a pint. A gallon is a lot more than that, you know.
I'll buy you a round.
I'll buy you a round. What is that, 4 gallons of beer?
And yeah. People do this all the time, right? If one of your friends needs help moving, a lot of the time, you know, they'll mm-hmm. bring beer. Or right. you'll drink a bit while you're moving furniture.
Yeah.
Doing physical labor.
It's very true. And if you think about it, again, this kind of gets us back to the point, Anil, you're talking about consumption, right? In social relations. Again, because money, for us, cash money, doesn't carry the same, for whatever reason, moral compass or moral ideas about mm-hmm. money. I mean, money doesn't carry the same moral ideas about back and forth or like reciprocity. But beer seems to have that in a different way. Again, possibly because it's a material thing that you consume and then you can have it together. Like you can't right. share money together. Let's hold this dollar bill together. You know, it doesn't mean the same thing versus let's have a beer. Let's talk. You know, it's an invitation to something more than just an economic transaction, right?
Exactly.
It's a social transaction.
And there's so much socially around beer because when you give it out, you know, it's a prized commodity. Exactly what we're saying. But with beer, there comes a time and a place where you can do it. You know, there has to be certain social conditions in place. You know, it's saying, I'm not going to be drinking on the job, or I'm not going to be noticeably drunk on the job. I'll be doing this with people in certain settings after hours, and I'll be fine to do the thing the next day. You know, you have to put those things in place before you can really even get more into it, right?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, even the act of consuming beer continues so many relationships. In a way, there's some people and companies that will even, you know, drinking might be a primary part of their job. When you go, you know, try to get new contracts with people, especially in Asia, you have a huge drinking culture.
Right.
In Japan, you'll see lots of salarymen, business employees passed out in the metro stations at night because they've had so much alcohol. That was basically, they were made to drink by their superiors in the company. So you have, you know, lots of times where beer becomes a huge part and a very important part in social relationships, creating our cultures to a degree.
I'll put links up to these studies later on tonight on our website. But there's been a number of cases where beer has actually shown a fostering of creativity with people in the workplace. So if you have one or two drinks at work, it's enough to keep you creative in a way that, again, fosters innovation, like we've been saying. You know, too much, and of course, well, things start to get sluggish. But with just enough, it ends up being a great innovative source.
Hmm. It really raises some interesting questions, because again, that ties into sort of the social norms and taboos of when and where one can mm-hmm. drink. But it's interesting when sort of latter scientific studies like this come out, some neurological studies that do say there is something about it, or and this is a parallel kind of example, but again, there's notions that like smoking certain amounts of marijuana or ingesting certain kinds of marijuana can actually produce some neurogenesis and different kind of things, or nootropics, and taking certain kinds of prescription pills can actually help your brain generate. Same with beer. Again, partially ties us back, of course, to the material reality of our world, and that we are biological beings, and that different cultures of yeast or whatever affect our bodies in certain ways. But at the same time, too, different cultures of social relations will tell us when and where we can, how much we should or shouldn't, with whom, without whom we should be drinking or not drink, right?
Exactly.
Or ingest these substances.
Yeah. And reciprocity seems to be such a huge and vital piece in all of this. Thinking about Marcel Mauss and the gift, and really the role of reciprocity, of gift-giving in creating our societies.
Absolutely.
And creating an idea that we're going to continue certain relationships. I notice in England, when people get together, you know, you buy a round, and then the next person buys a round, and the next person buys a round, and by the end of the night, you know, obviously there's this idea of it'll continue. We'll remember this night, we'll remember the rounds, there's almost a tally, and then you pick it up again the next couple of days, and that... So there's this almost economic tie, but then there's also the idea that you want that inequality to happen at the end of the day, because that shows that you want to continue the relationship. You want to see this person again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And something else that strikes me about that, again, that Mauss talks about is like the thing with the gift, of course, is that you're right. It's this invitation in some ways to ongoing social relations because it's unequal. Like I give to you, then you must give back to me. But also with that is this notion of the spirit of the gift. There's some way it's called the how, is what they say in Melanesian. It's like the spirit of the giver. There's something about the giver that goes into the gift they give you. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because actually Sam Calagione, who is part of Dogfish Head, he has this interesting quote. There's a documentary coming out, or maybe I'll call it Crafting a Nation, about craft breweries, and a lot of it's about Dogfish Head. And he says that, you know, he's talking about the four ingredients we mentioned before of sort of what goes into a beer. But Calagione says that, like, it's not just about these four ingredients, but it's about you put your soul into this. You know, so this is what struck me. You put your spirit into this, and then you pass that on to the customer. This is very Maussian, and I think very worthwhile to think about. It's not just about the ingredients, you know, but again, it's about putting your passion into this beer, and it's about the customer's enjoyment, too. I think a really compelling way to think about, as you said, Anil, this ongoing notion of reciprocity that beer has in it in a special way that some other things may not quite so much. Beer is a good example of, I suppose, right? It's very visible. Yeah.
The quote actually makes the production of beer sound like an art.
Yeah, good way of saying it, yeah.
Something that we give out again and again, or we give out in one singular piece that people keep, you know, coming back to pay reference to in certain ways.
Well, and if you think about, yeah, art versus, like, mechanized production, right? Art has this notion of, like, artisanal, right? Handmade, small-scale production, tender care put into it, like good knowledge of the product. Really, I think it's a great way to talk about it, right? And I think that the craft brewing culture that we do see here in Massachusetts and other, I mean, tons of places, Portland, Oregon, absolutely. I mean, tons of places in the U.S., around the world. But just from what I know here in Somerville and Cambridge in Massachusetts, right? This, I think, artisanal is hitting the nail on the head, right? That's exactly right. It's just they talk about it like this art and soul project, right? It's much more than we're just making a drink. We're making a buck. We have a business. No, these people put everything into these businesses, and they talk about them like it is this. Almost if we want to talk about Max Weber, it's like spiritual calling, right? There's something about
it's a vocation.
A vocation, yeah. That's the word, yeah. And what do you think about vocation?
Yeah, it's a huge thing in this. Especially you see it if you guys check out Crafting a Nation. Even if you look at the trailer, it shows these guys who are really trying to start up their microbrewery, and they're putting everything into it. Mm. They're going into debt. You know, their fears that the bank will come and take their brewery away, take everything, all of their hard work. They're pouring their souls into it. And even the title of that documentary, Crafting a Nation, the idea of, you know, even the nation being really intricately involved in this beer, the idea that everything really, you know, it's completely embedded to a degree. And that, I really feel, is where vocation comes in. You know, vocation originally relating a lot to the priesthood and the calling to serve God, right? Mm. The idea, it's an extreme dedication to a certain path.
Absolutely, yeah. And just to kind of tag on to the notion of a priesthood, actually, one of the things I found when researching for the show is that here in Massachusetts, there's a company that's applied to do a Trappist Abbey, to make a Trappist Abbey ale. And this is a very specific kind of beer. This is actually during the Middle Ages, this was actually, one of the ways the church made money was that monks would brew beer, and this is the famous Trappist ale. There are 7 abbeys in the world that make Trappist monk ale. Massachusetts will have number 8, which is very cool, I think. I'm excited if this happens. It'll be very cool. So again, it's a very small way of making beer, but again, it's one of the longstanding traditions from Europe to here. But I'm excited to see that. So I'm speaking of vocations. We're going to see. We may see the rise of an abbey that makes a certain kind of Trappist beer.
And thinking about how these ideas continue in our current day, even, you know, the idea of being a Trappist abbey or being Trappist monks. Actually, this morning I was having some bread with soup, and the bread was made from by Trappist monks, according to the bag. And Trappist monks was actually trademarked. So it's I found it fascinating to think about, because, you know, you think Trappist monks, a tradition that's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. How could that be trademarked? And yet it was. So, I mean, I think that brings up a lot of ideas of how do we continue certain traditions? Because if you see a trademark, I feel there's almost an assumption that there's a threat that it's going to be used badly, or there's an idea that it's going to be used without authenticity. Mm. Or it could be inauthentic people trademarking it to use it themselves, as the case was with a Texas corporation trademarking Basmati rice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have to agree with you. Warner Brothers in recent years and currently is going through these different processes to, you know, to trademark different logos for superheroes. Not just to get the rights for their own personal good, but to sort of crystallize that these specific heroes in comic books will exist in the future. So that nobody can just do away with them. That they'll be continued to be used.
And to have the only authentic use of them, right?
Uh-huh.
And it's really kind of interesting to think about with beer. Besides beer and superheroes being cool. But but the notion of how does intellectual property and patents work with beers? Because beer, as we can see, is a constant experimentation of craft, right? And we might call it of an artisanal production, particularly from these small craft breweries. So it raises some interesting questions of, like, what is the authentic production of beer like? And again, what ingredients can you use? And as we said before, when you go on a tour, you're going to learn about the specific location of where the hops came from, where the barley came from, where the wheat, depending on what they're making, where the lemons, where the oranges, if you're going to go see Blue Moon or something, right? There'll be this, again, this location-based idea, identity. But again, with patenting and stuff, I mean, will we, or are we ever going to see a difference? I don't know, because, I mean, as I said before, too, then there's some application for some 22 new breweries just in Massachusetts. So,
right.
Again, obviously, these can't make totally new things every single day. They can't make new beers every time. They're all going to. But again, making a lager versus a pilsner has a general recipe, right? You can add some coriander, some spices, cinnamon, orange, whatever to sort of, you know, additives to the flavor. But again, at the same time, there's a general recipe that we've been saying that go back thousands of years for some of these, right?
And now what we're getting at with that is really tradition, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's going to constitute something that has, a sort of call to the past, but also that we'd like to see continued into the future? And this is a little bit of a point of contention because we tend to think of new beers coming in as seasonal things with different flavors. But will that stand the test of time? A lot of these things are just, well, it's a new thing, it's flavorful, it's a trend. But it's not the tradition that these other beers are. So how these different recipes get trademarked is in some ways accounting for that legitimacy.
That's a great thing to think about, particularly as we see the rise of these small breweries, right? Because they're going to have to invent something new to be in business, for one, but then they also sell sort of, an identity with this, right? Mm-hmm. Same with kind of the superhero thing, I guess is what I was thinking of. It's that it's never just Batman, but it's the way Batman's suit is put together, the way the Batmobile looks, you know, the way the logo is. Same
right.
with the beers, too, the logo on the can or the bottle, what image that the brewers want to present of themselves, where they want to sell their product.
And it doesn't even have to be in the taste of the beer, right? Mm-hmm. It can be the ideas, the things that you learn from the bottle, what the information is what information is given to consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these issues relate to Heather Paxson's Life of Cheese, right?
Mm.
Where she talks about the idea of artisanal cheese and what really makes a cheese artisanal and what ideas are behind the notion of artisanship and what social and cultural capital does it give us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's this idea that a lot of people feel better when they're drinking a locally produced beer. You know, when you've gone to the brewery, when you've seen the ingredients and whatnot, you feel a connection. And a lot of that relates to, you know, culture and how human beings, we have almost a need to constantly be making meaning, and we love engaging things that give us meaning. And so by providing us with this information, microbreweries engage us. They make us feel that there's something special about them that Anheuser-Busch might not have, although Anheuser-Busch is also trying to make it seem that there's something very special about Budweiser
right.
and their other products.
But therein lies an issue here, and that's that these brands that have this marketed tradition as being something sort of outside of time, right? They're sort of monumental in what they represent. That, you know, a Budweiser, a Coors, a Miller, you know what to expect. You know what you're getting when you get that, and it references somebody's name from long ago. So to break from that causes a little bit of contention. Are you still following along with the tradition, or are you changing it entirely? So what type of leeway is granted to these long-standing companies and what they can, you know, use to produce something new? And is going to be a little bit different than what we'll see with the craft brewers who are trying to establish themselves.
Hmm. And I think that's why, I think what I hear you guys getting at is this, what Heather Paxson talks about is this notion of the economies of sentiment, right? It's that there's a feeling that goes with it too, right? Again, it's about this whole package or even what, Caligione was talking about, putting your soul into this, right? And craft brews give us, as we've been saying, the sense of place that Anheuser-Busch may not have. However, if you think about Budweiser, right, they're very place-based in terms of this is an American beer. So it's not like a Ipswich, Massachusetts. Right, Milwaukee's finest, right? And so they are still place-based, even though they're quite big in scope. And so it's interesting to see that we can see the use of place in different contexts, but they're trying to do the same kind of thing, making us feel attached and selling a certain kind of thing, right? Again, I think the advantage that people see with craft breweries now is, I mean, in some ways a result of the slow food movement that began in the 70s, right, in Italy, but it moved over here as a response to fast food and to corporate industrial food production, like artisanal cheese, which is actually a fairly new phenomenon in the United States. I mean, it's been... Artisanal cheese is not new, but like the rise of it as a new product to buy is fairly new. Mm-hmm. But again, it comes with these notions of these economies of sentiment, or these feelings that, you know, we are here to keep all of our products that we buy local in Vermont. We are going to use cows that are raised right here on our farm. You know, we're going to get wheat from the guy down the road a little bit. You know, and again, a very place based product that supports a certain idea, right?
Exactly. We might think of this. We might think of this as the beerscape, right? Our beerscape has changed drastically over the last, ever since beer came into being, because your options are growing. And the way that we access beer and the way that we're able to transport beer, as we've talked about, has undergone innovation after innovation after innovation to give us more options, to fuel that ever-increasing desire to have something exotic. Mm.
You heard it here first, folks, the beerscape. This anthropological life.
There'll be a book coming out fairly soon. But yeah, I think, you know, what we've been really describing is a lot of this engagement, how we create something in the present while we still want to keep ideas from the past, and then also we want to create new things. In a way, you know, Dogfish is exciting because they're creating these beverages that no one's tasted for, you know, probably they've actually never tasted these beverages, honestly. Although they're inspired by these past recipes, the production style is, you know, it's relatively recent. And, you know, even with Sam Adams, right, to my knowledge, no member of the Adams family has ever worked for Sam Adams. Although it's possible maybe there's some very, very distant person. But of course, you know, Sam Adams was a very historical figure. Mm-hmm. And beer did have a role in the creation of this country, as we were saying earlier, with the pilgrims stopping at Plymouth because they ran out of beer, the Green Dragon Tavern in Boston.
Right, you can go drink where Paul Revere was drinking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Where the actual Sam Adams was plotting things, you know.
Exactly.
But it's true. I mean, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were brewers. It's interesting that, like, it's in some ways what we might say is in the American DNA, right, that brewing has been with us for a long time. What's kind of interesting to me with this, too, is the notion of, as we were saying, kind of the size of it, like, just to kind of explain craft versus, like, you know, Anheuser-Busch or something, right? And so what the American Brewers Association talks about is that, so craft just, because this is curious to me, I was interested that, like, so they have to make 6 million barrels of beer or less a year. 6 million is a lot. One barrel is 330 bottles. So 6 million times 330, I can't even, you know, I'm not going to do the math.
It's a large number.
It's a lot of beer, right? And so, yes. Just for example, in 2011... Anheuser-Busch sold 17.7 million barrels of just Budweiser.
Wow.
Sam Adams is the largest craft brewery in the United States, and they produce 2.4 million barrels of beer. And I used to have a friend that worked at the Sam Adams Brewery, and it's interesting, there's always a funny contention between, like, is Sam Adams actually a craft brewery? Because they're available everywhere in the United States for the most part. You know, and I do often get asked if I go home to Texas or travel somewhere in the U.S. and I say I live in Boston, like, oh, you want to get a Sam Adams? I'm like, no, I can get those in Boston, you know, but it's, you can get them everywhere else too. So the question is, like, what, again, the notion of being craft, does that have to do with how far the availability goes? We can,
yeah,
this it, placeness, you know.
It's also interesting because the majority of Sam Adams is also brewed in Ohio, I believe.
I think you're right. Yeah. It's brewed in three different places, yeah. Uh-huh. As you said, the factory, or what we actually might better say is the museum of Sam Adams is here.
Right.
In Jamaica Plain in Massachusetts,
which is
right?
Actually, I think, one of the smallest Sam Adams breweries, which may have, you know, been facilitative to Sam Adams drinkers in the past, but certainly not today.
Yeah, no, it's lost its commercial potential, but it's gained this cultural value.
Mm-hmm.
As we were talking earlier, how, you know, you had the IPAs being sent to India as a kind of a way to preserve. You know, there's this change that is always happening.
Exactly.
With the places that we use. our own culture, our activities, and even these companies. You know, companies evolve. Mm-hmm. If any of you guys have seen, you know, that movie about Facebook that came out, the social network. I think it actually did a good job showing the progression of this company. And even Jobs, you know, I really didn't like that movie, but it too also right. showed the progression of Apple. As you know, this one young guy, but then you have all these other people who just come in, mm-hmm. and they bring money. But there's also the idea. There's the idea that Steve Jobs is really instrumental to Apple, even though you know so much of the growth of the company came from other people coming in. I think as human beings also relates to our need to create meaning is we create these symbols and we map these symbols onto actual people and places, you know, as exactly. we're seeing with the Sam Adams Brewery.
And to continue with that, it's not just places, but we're also implicating time. And as Anil brought up earlier, there's a heavy, heavy, heavy emphasis on experience here. Mm. And I'm going to toy around this beerscape idea just a little bit more. To suggest that, you know, maybe there's something about that beer. There's something about the experience of that beer that gets at those experiences that were held in the past. That in some way, it connects you to those other people in the past, these other social settings. You can now identify with that and actually imbibe in something that could have been used hundreds of years, thousands of years, millennia, you know, before you.
That's true.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah, and it reminds us of you know, Hobbes, Bonner, Ranger's book, The Invention of Tradition, right? Because mm-hmm. this is true. We are delving many ways in the past. We've talked about McGovern a number of times, the different yes. ingredients he's gone into Egyptian sarcophagi and old peat bogs and, you know, these old Indiana Jones fun places. Not to get artifacts, or yes, to get artifacts, but not the kind we're thinking of. Not looking for the Ark of the Covenant, but he's looking for maybe the Ark of the Covenant lager or something, right? A specific yeah. kind of drinks, you know, but then again, that
the beer
ties
that
us
will
from then,
yeah. destroy the Nazis.
It's got to be one out there somewhere, right?
Yeah, somewhere.
And this is archaeology with real world application, right?
Literally.
We are having archaeologists go out, find recipes, or extrapolate the chemical residues mm-hmm. from these yeah. former drinks, recreate them, and then give them to you. So the past is really coming to the foreground here.
And you experience it. And exactly. we can even take this idea of beerscape and bring it very close to home as, you know, we are on a campus. We're on Brandeis University. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even in the ethos of higher education, there's the idea that you're learning, but there's also the idea that of drinking, right? Which That's comes true. Out in so much of our media and our culture. You think National Lampoon, Van Wilder, all of these movies, Animal House, you know, all of these things. I think it has a huge place in the idea of, you know, even education to a degree.
Right. In some ways, it's sewn in, as you were saying before, there's these new studies that say a little bit of beer may actually help the brain kickstart a bit, you know?
Exactly.
And it's funny that at institutions of higher education, we have the similar but different, you know, importance placed on alcohol and beer consumption as part of, in some ways, the experience of higher education itself, right?
Exactly. There's an emphasis for graduate students to indulge in the TGIF here at Brandeis, the mm-hmm. first Friday of every month, to offer free beer for a number of hours to graduate students to help us unwind, meet people, and share in that sort of communal experience.
Mm-hmm. It's an important thing. And one point I just wanted to throw out there, this is a little tangential, but it's still related, is that beer, again, has been such an important part to humanity as a whole, right? Again, we talked about sort of the rise of using of barley from yesterday until today. But also, again, we saw the same thing happening in what would become the Americas, right? Again, with the Olmec, the Maya, the Aztec, the Quechua, the Inca. Like, these groups did a similar thing with what we call chicha, which is actually a corn beer. So it's interesting to think about that, you know, it happened with barley sort of in the, quote, Western world, and then in the, quote, New World, they had the same thing happen but with corn. And so, regardless of the actual food or the basis that became the beer, the process was still there. And it's very fascinating to think about this. Like, there's something, if we think about it again, there's something, for lack of a better term, universal about our application of beer.
And we are somehow yeah. selecting for the yeast and the chemical reactions mm-hmm. it has with the plants that we are consuming to create this sort of beverage. And again, we're always drinking it in the beverage form, which is the importance here.
Yeah, we're not eating fermented corn, uh-huh. right? We're drinking it. I guess you could eat fermented corn. I don't know. But
yeah, I think you can. I'm not yeah. sure I'd want to.
Some degree.
We'll stick to the drink for now.
Yeah. Of course, I mean, with this experience, so many things are connected to it. As we've been talking about, you know, there's the social, there are the people coming together, there are the vessels involved, and even there are the other foodstuffs involved. And, you know, so many other different types of plants and animals involved in this whole kind of ecosystem. I think, Adam, before the show, we were talking a little bit about The Botany of Desire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very interesting book in that, you know, he traces the real value of certain plants and how they've grown with us.
Right.
You know, and how we started off the show thinking about barley and the importance of barley and how it almost created a sedentary lifestyle.
Yeah.
Or was really the pivotal plant that drew humans to really want to have a sedentary lifestyle.
Yeah, it's a great question to talk about the notion of coevolution, right? Mm-hmm. We always talk about, we actually talked about this in the multi-species and the supplemental episode I did. Anna Singh talks about this too, in that, you know, with the rise of agriculture, we always talk about that humans domesticated crops and, quote, bend nature to our will, which is really not true at all. Again, the idea is we co-evolved with these plants. And that barley happened to be one of the good plants that grows along with us very easily. And it's worth thinking about. You know, I think you're absolutely right, Anil, to raise the idea of, like, Michael Pollan does a good job, too, in The Botany of Desire, right? Very accessible of how different plants, marijuana, apples, corn, these different plants grow with us. You know, and we grow with them.
And even, you know, thinking about Bruno Latour and actor network theory.
Yeah.
Right? And really breaking down, you know, thinking about people, but also everything else involved.
Yeah, absolutely right.
But yeah, no, it's huge.
It is. I mean, that's, and beer is just, it's a huge part of, again, where we come from and probably where we're going. And speaking of that, there's a, maybe on a last note, I think one of the funny things is at the end of the How Beer Saved the World documentary, there's a push of beer's next move into space. And there's a brewery in New Zealand that is trying to make the first space available beer. And beer can't go to space right now because of carbonation. Again, when you go to space, liquid and gas don't separate in the same way they do because of gravity. And so the big concern, of course, is you're going to have what's called a wet burp, which we all, you know what that is if it's happened to you, yeah. Right? And in space, there's no separation, so the gas will not be separated from the liquid, so you can't drink beer. It'll just keep coming back up, which sounds pretty unpleasant. So they're trying to brew this sort of flat beer that can go to space, but it has the same properties. Again, fermentation naturally produces effervescence or bubbles, right? So there's an interesting kind of challenge there of what to do with that.
Huh. So that's fascinating. And so that actually, it seems to relate to what we're talking about with IPAs.
Yeah.
And how, you know, that was created for a real reason, you know, almost a scientific reason. And now we have this new type of beer that's also being created for a scientific reason. But maybe, you know, the new age hipsters hundreds of years from now, that'll be the beer that they're associated
with.
It's
true. With the rise of space tourism.
The beer you can drink in space. Yeah.
It also makes me wonder what types of different alcoholic beverages or different types of beers have existed and how we've become most likely entangled to specific sets of these choices. And it might be interesting to understand how that might develop through time as well.
Yeah, and again, that's just the notion of coevolution, right?
Right.
These new flavors aren't, some way maybe accidents, but again, we select for certain ones, right? And so why do we see certain ones coming in and leaving and then other ones showing up after that? And is space beer the new thing? I don't know.
Yeah.
Will it be an IPA or a lager or a stout? I don't know.
And it might be connected to a nation or one of our countries.
That's a great question.
And people will feel incredibly powerful about it. You know, we might think, you know, it's funny to think about this in kind of a way, but then people really do care about this stuff. You know, especially you see it in Crafting a Nation, the documentary, you know, just the emotions involved and how powerfully people can be moved by beer.
Right.
It's amazing.
But even the way the production of the actual trailer, right? It's playing this, like, you know, Bruce Springsteen, American music, you know, with this slow guitar, singing about adversity and overcoming it, and, you know, and guys talking about trying to make beer, and like, oh, I mean, my wife worked here 24 hours a day, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's true. There's definitely a sentiment and a pride, absolutely. You know, in the late 60s, 70s, we got the first man on the moon. Now we're going to get the first beer in space, you know. And
yeah.
Might be New Zealand, you know.
And, it could be as big as having the American flag on the moon.
It could be, right?
When we have the first empty beer bottle that's been left.
could be.
That's good. Well, I think, you know, we've gone over a lot of really fascinating issues relating to beer and,
indeed,
you know, how we view it, what its role is in our society, what it's connected to, the emotions involved. You know, it's just such a multifaceted subject.
It is, yeah. Our co-evolution with beer, the domestication of crops, domestication of ourselves, the rise of the United States, industrialization, refrigeration, who knows? It's very implicated in much of our lives, and I guess the best we can say now is you know, go out and enjoy yourself a nice beer, knowing a little bit more about it if you're of age, of course.
Right. There you go. Don't do it if you're underage.
Yeah.
Gotta wait. That's also a cultural thing
that
we must take very seriously.
Indeed. If we would have had more time, we could have definitely gone into this. But perhaps we should just say cheers.
Yeah,
cheers. Yeah. Huh? Go drink a beer, as the country western song says.
That's right.
All right. Well,
this is Adam Gamble signing off.
This is Ryan Collins.
And this is Neil Tripathi. Thanks, you guys, for listening to the first episode of the second season of This Anthropological Life. And we'll be back next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Have a good week, guys.